This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Personal Injuries, written by Scott Turow, read by Mark Bramhall. The Beginning. Welcome, thou kind deceiver, thou best of thieves, who with an easy key dost open life, and unperceived by us, even steal us from ourselves. John Dryden, All for Love. Chapter 1. He knew it was wrong, and that he was going to get caught. He said he knew this day was coming. He knew they had been stupid, he told me. Worse, greedy. He said he knew he should have stopped. But somehow, each time he thought they'd quit, he'd ask himself how once more could make it any worse. Now he knew he was in trouble. I recognized the tune. Over 20-some years, the folks sitting in that leather club chair in front of my desk have found only a few old standards in the jukebox. I didn't do it. The other one did it. Why are they picking on me? His selection, I'm sorry, made the easiest listening. But they all wanted to hear the same song from me. Maybe I can get you out of this. I said it, usually, although I knew it would often prove untrue. But it's a complicated business being somebody's only hope. This is a lawyer's story, the kind attorneys like to hear and tell, about a case, about a client. His name was Robert Favor. Everyone knew him as Robbie, although he was getting old for that kind of thing. 43, he'd said when I asked his age. The time was 1992, the second week in September. The pundits had finally stopped predicting that Ross Perot was going to be the next president of the United States, and the terms dot and com had not yet been introduced to one another. I recall the period precisely because the week before I had returned to Virginia to lay my father to rest. His passing, which over the years I'd assumed I would take as being in the natural order of things, had instead imbued all my waking moments with the remote quality of dreams, so that even my hand, when I considered it, seemed disconnected from my body. Robbie Favor's troubles were more immediate. Last night, three special agents of the Internal Revenue Service's Criminal Intelligence Division had visited him at home, one to talk and two to listen. They were, as you would expect, rumpled men in inexpensive sport coats, grave but polite. They had handed him a grand jury subpoena for all of his law partnership's financial records and tried to ask Robbie questions about his income tax returns. Wisely, he had refused to reply. He could suit himself, responded the one agent who spoke. But they wanted to tell him a couple things, good news and bad. Bad first. They knew. They knew what Robbie and his law partner, Morton Dinnerstein, had been up to. They knew that for several years the two had occasionally deposited a check they received when they won or settled one of their personal injury cases in a secret account at River National Bank, where the firm transacted no other business. They knew that out of the River National account, Dinnerstein and Robbie had paid the usual shares of what they'd earned, 2/3 to the clients, 1/9 to the referring attorneys, odd amounts to experts or court reporters. Everyone had received his due, except the IRS. They knew that for years now, Favor and his partner had been writing checks to cash to draw down the balance of the account, never paying a dime in tax.
You guys are cold-cocked, the agent added.
Robbie laughed now, very briefly, repeating the words. I didn't ask how Robbie and his partner could have ever believed a scheme so simple-minded would work. I was long accustomed to the dumb ways people get themselves in trouble. Besides, the fact was that their scam had operated smoothly for years. A checking account that paid no interest was unlikely to come to the service's attention. It was, frankly, noteworthy that it had, a development that would inevitably be traced to freak coincidence, or, if things were spicier, betrayal. Favor had heard out the agents in his living room. He was perched on a camelback sofa, smartly upholstered in bleached silk, trying to contain himself, to smile, stay slick. He opened his mouth to speak, but was interrupted by the unexpected sensation of a single cold rill of his own sweat tracking the length of his side until it was absorbed in the elastic waistband of his boxers.
"And the good news?" he asked, on second effort.
"They were getting to that," the agent said. The good news was that Robbie had an opportunity. Maybe there was something he could do for himself, something that a person with his family situation ought to consider. The agent then walked across the marble foyer and opened the front door. The United States attorney, Stan Sennett, was standing on Robbie's doorstep. Favor recognized him from TV, a short man, slender, kempt with a compulsive orderliness. A few gnats zagged madly under the light above the careful part in Sennett's head. He greeted Favor with his in-court expression, humorless as a hatchet blade. Robbie had never practiced a day of criminal law, but he knew what it meant that the United States attorney was standing in person on his front stoop late at night. It meant the biggest gun was pointed straight at him. It meant they wanted to make him an example. It meant he'd never get away. In his terror, Robbie Favor found a single useful thought.
"I want a lawyer," he said. He was entitled, Sennett finally responded. But perhaps Robbie should listen to him first.
As soon as Sennett set a polished brogan across the threshold, Robbie repeated himself. "I can't promise the deal will be the same tomorrow," Sennett told him.
"Lawyer,"
Favor said again. The agents took over then, offering advice. If he was going to an attorney, find a good one, someone who'd been around. Talk to that lawyer and no one else. Not Mom, not the wife, and certainly not his law partner, Dinnerstein. The U.S. attorney passed one agent his card, and the agent handed it to Favor. Sennett would be waiting for Favor's lawyer's call. About to step down into the darkness, the prosecutor asked over his shoulder whether Robbie had anyone in mind. "Interesting choice," Sennett told Favor with a shallow smile when he heard my name.
"I'm not a rat," Robbie Favor said now. "That's the play, right, George? They want me to dime somebody out."
I asked if he had any idea who. "Well, it better not be Mort."
"My partner? Never. There's nothing to say about Mort."
Favor and Dinnerstein were lifelong friends, he told me. Next-door neighbors as boys growing up in the Jewish enclave of Warren Park here in DuSable. Roommates through college and law school. But their secret account was joint. Both men had made deposits and written the checks to cash, and neither had reported the income. There was enough damaging paper that it seemed unlikely the IRS was going to need anyone's assistance to install either one of them in the trophy case. I asked if there might be something else the government wanted Robbie to tell them about Mort, or any other person, but Favor hitched a shoulder limply, looking lost. I did not know Robbie Favor well. When he'd called this morning, he'd reminded me that we'd met several times in the lobby of the Le Sueur building where we each had our law offices and of the committee work he'd done for the Kendall County Bar Association a couple of years ago during my term as president. My memories of him were vague and not necessarily pleasant. Measured according to the remaining reflexes of a proper Southern upbringing, he was the kind of fellow who'd be described simply as too much. Too good-looking in the sense that he was too well aware of it, too much stiff, dark hair that reflected too much fussing. He was tanned in every season and spent too much money on his clothes, high-styled Italian suits and snazzy foulards, accompanied by too much jewelry. He spoke too loudly and too eagerly to strangers in the elevator. In fact, in any setting, he talked too much. One of those people who went one up on Descartes, "I speak, therefore I am." But I now saw one apparent virtue. He could have told you all of that. Diminished by fear, he maintained an air of candor, at least about himself. As clients went, therefore, he seemed, on first impression, better than average. When I asked what the agent had meant about his family, he sagged a bit. "Sick wife," he said. "Sick mother." Waging a running war against the medical establishment, Favor, like many personal injury attorneys, had absorbed the lexicon of physicians. His mother was in a nursing home. "CVA," he said, meaning a stroke. His wife, Lorraine, was worse. She had been diagnosed nearly 2 years ago with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or more commonly Lou Gehrig's disease, and was on a certain downward course toward total paralysis and eventually death. "She's got a year maybe before things get really hairy. No one knows for sure." He was stoical, but his black eyes did not rise from the carpet. "I mean, I can't leave her. Not practically. There's nobody else to take care of her." That was the agent's point. Favor would talk or be in the penitentiary when his wife reached the point of total helplessness or passed. The dark shroud of that prospect fell over us both. In the resulting silence, I picked up Sennett's card, which Favor had laid on my desk. Without it, I might have questioned whether Robbie had identified the right man on his doorstep. The United States attorney, with 92 assistants and several hundred cases to supervise, would ordinarily have no direct role in a straightforward tax case, even one against a successful personal injury lawyer. Whatever Stan Sennett had come to Robbie's house to say last night must have been a mouthful.
"What did it mean?" Favor asked. "When Sennett said that George Mason would be an interesting choice, does he hate your guts or think you're a pushover?"
"It was complicated," I responded. I believed in some moods Stan would say I was a close friend.
"Well, that's good then, isn't it?" Favor asked.
When it came to Stan Sennett, I never knew the answer. "Sometimes friends," I told Favor. "Always rivals." Chapter 2. In the fashion of most high-ranking bureaucrats, the United States Attorney's personal office was vast. The shag carpeting was tattered at places into little raveled strands, and the drapes of greenish raw silk had covered the wall of windows on the north since sometime in the 50s. But the space could be measured by the acre. There was a bathroom with a shower and a hideaway study. In the corners of the principal space, a sturdy government-issue conference table stood on one side, while across the room various endangered species seized by fish and wildlife inspectors from a rogue taxidermist were displayed in a long row of mahogany cases. A bald eagle and a spotted snake adjoined something that looked like a marmoset. Behind a desk the size of a tomb, Stan Sennett, one of those dark, driven little men who turn up so often in the law, rose to greet me.
"Hey there, Georgie," he said.
I attributed this rare mood of impressive good cheer to Stan's eagerness to talk about Favor. "Blue stuff," I told his secretary when she offered coffee. We loitered a minute over personal details.
Stan showed off the photos of his only child, Asha, a 3-year-old girl, dark and gorgeous, whom Stan and his second wife, Nora Flynn, had adopted after years of futile fertility treatments and in vitro. I recounted the leisurely progress of my 2 sons through their higher educations and bragged for a second about my wife, Patrice, an architect who had just won an international design competition to build a spectacular art museum in Bangkok. Stan, who'd been stationed in Thailand in 1966, told me a few funny stories about the country. In his most relaxed moments, Stan Sennett could be a delight, a stylish wit, an amusing collector of arcane facts, and a canny observer of the fur-licking and hissing in local political circles. The rest of the time, you had to deal with a more complicated package. 1,000 megahertz mind and a pot full of seething emotions liable to scald anybody nearby before Stan managed to slam down the lid. He had graduated first in our class at Easton Law School. At the bar, it is possible to travel forever in the slipstream of law school success. But Stan had bypassed the riches or policy pinnacles in Washington that usually reward his kind of legal intellect. He was a prosecutor. After clerking for Chief Justice Berger, he had returned to Kendall County to join the prosecuting attorney's office, rising on indisputable merit until he became Raymond Horgan's chief deputy. In the early 80s, when his first marriage dissolved, he joined the U.S. Justice Department. He went first to San Diego, then D.C., and had just returned to California when President Bush named him U.S. attorney here. He had established relations with local law enforcement agencies and no political ambitions. He therefore had figured to make it through his 4-year term, which would end next year, uncompromised by the cabals and rivalries that had broken out after the death of our legendary mayor and county executive, Augustine Bolcaro. Like most persons, I was wary of Stan's lethal side, but we had always been companions in the law. As students, we shared our learning. He informed me of the deeper implications of the cases we studied. I was, so far as I know, the first person to tell him that a gentleman did not tuck his necktie into his trousers. In practice, we had been ongoing opponents since he became a deputy PA while I was in my first legal job with the state defenders. At all times, we were tied together by a mutual admiration that bordered on envy. My casual, high-born manner, a false front in my eyes and thus always something of a burden, represented an ideal, I think, to Sennett, for whom sincerity and charm were mutually exclusive. I was impressed first by Stan's abilities, but even more by his committed sense of high purpose. Some in the defense bar, like my friend Sandy Stern, could not abide Sennett's sanctimony or his ham-handed methods, such as his late-night intrusion on favor. But Stan was the first U.S. attorney in my quarter of a century here who was fearlessly independent. He'd begun a long-overdue era of zero tolerance for the scams and dirty dealing that were forever viewed as a perk of local office. And he took on the mighty commercial interests like Moreland Insurance, the largest private employer in Kendall County, whom Stan had nonetheless prosecuted for fraud. Sennett's agenda, in short, had been to let the light of the law into the crabbed corners of Kendall County, and as his friend, I often found myself applauding behind the mask of horror I was required to wear as a defense lawyer. Eventually, he turned to my new client. "Odd fellow, I take it," Stan said with a calculating glimpse my way. We both knew that even dressed up in Armani, Robbie Favor was your basic Kendall County hustler, complete with South End accent and too much cologne. No, he must be peculiar, because what they did with that account over at River National was pretty strange. The partnership of Favor and Dinnerstein hasn't reported an annual income of less than 1 mil for a decade. 4's been more the average. I hope you knew that, George, when you set your retainer. A sweet little smile zipped by,
the proper revenge of a man who's lived his life within the confines of a government salary.
Odd to be chiseling 40K on taxes when you're showing numbers like that, isn't it?
I dipped a shoulder. The explanation would never make sense to anyone but them, yet over the years I had learned that it was only the poor whose desire for money was bounded by pure reason.
And here's something stranger, George. They'll go months sometimes without a hit on this account. Then, boom, it's $10,000-$15,000 in cash inside a week. And in the meantime, George, they both bang their ATMs on a regular basis. So why this sudden appetite for currency? Stan asked. And where's it going?
Offshore. Drugs. The usual. Not to mention more eternal vices not banned by the Federal Criminal Code.
Something on the side?
Asked Stan when I suggested that alternative.
And how? Your fellow needs an odometer on his zipper.
He rolled his eyes as if he no longer recalled that it was a weakness for one of the secretaries at the PA's office that had ended his first marriage. I mentioned the sick wife, and Sennett chuckled archly. Robbie Favor, he said, had been enshrined long before in the Hall of Fame down on Grand Avenue, the strip of high-end watering holes often referred to as the Street of Dreams.
But Mort's a solid family man, he said. And your guy sees more beds than a hotel maid. He's not paying any Tootsie's rent. So that's not where the money's going. Want to know my theory, George? I think it's the cash they're hiding, not the income.
Sennett unbent a paperclip and twirled it between his fingers. Behind the huge desk, he was smug as a fat house cat. Here was the essential Stan. The dark, narrow boy always in a heat to reestablish himself as the smartest person he knew. He had been born Constantine Nicholas Senatakis and was raised in back of the family restaurant.
You've been there, he told me dryly when we met in law school. Menu pages coated in plastic and one of the relatives chained to the cash register.
During his induction as U.S. attorney, he had misted over recounting his parents' struggles. But for the most part, all that ethnic opera, all that carrying on, was self-consciously left behind. Stan's public persona was as the sort of man who barely snapped his fingers when music played. In private, with friends and colleagues, he was apt to take on the droll pose of a grumpy initiate soiled by knowing it all. Yet to me, although it was shrewdly disguised, Stan remained full of teeming immigrant striving. His entire world was often at stake in a case, as if he had an inescapable obligation to rise and prosper at every opportunity. As a result, he suffered his losses far more intensely than he savored his many achievements. But he clearly knew he was winning now.
Aren't you going to ask how I stumbled over these fellows and their private cash machine?
I would have, had I thought he'd answer. But apparently Stan was having too much fun today to indulge his usual secretiveness.
Our friends at Moreland Insurance, said Sennett. They got our whiskers twitching.
I might have thought of that. Stan's fabled prosecution of Moreland for a series of fraudulent sales practices with which the company had gallivanted through the 80s concluded with the insurer sentenced to a staggering fine, more than $30 million, and also to a period of probation during which they were obliged to cooperate with the U.S. attorney in correcting any wrongdoing they knew of. I was not surprised to find that Moreland had taken the opportunity to tattle not only on themselves, but also on their natural enemies, plaintiffs' lawyers. In almost every personal injury suit, the real defendant is an insurance company. You may sue the neighbor whose tree fell on your house, but it's his insurance company who pay the damages and hire the defense attorneys, and which often feels antagonized by the lawyer on the other side. I realized that in all likelihood it was one of the checks Moreland had issued over the years to Favor and Dinnerstein that had been trailed to the partner's secret bank account. Unfortunately, though, Moreland's records had revealed more than that.
Your guy's a tough opponent, Stan said. Somehow, every time Moreland has a big case against these fellas, the company just can't win a ruling. By now, they've learned to settle, especially since any lawsuit where your guy is looking at a six-figure fee always ends up in front of one of a handful of judges. And guess what? We crawled through the records in the courthouse, and it turns out the pattern holds for other companies. Whenever Favor and Dinnerstein has a big payday coming, it's the same deal. Bad rulings, big settlements. And the same four distinguished jurists on their cases, George, even though there are 19 judges sitting in the Common Law Claims Division, all of whom are supposed to be assigned to matters at random.
Sennett issued a stiff look.
Know now where I'm thinking the cash is going, George?
I knew.
Rumors of funny business had lingered like some untraceable foundation odor in the Kendall County courthouses since I'd arrived here for law school. But no one had ever proved it. The judges who took were said to be carefully insulated. There were bagmen and code words, and the lawyers who paid told no tales. It was, by report, a small faction, a secret society whose alliances were fierce and ancient, going back decades to high schools, churches, to the prosecuting attorney's office in its bad old days, to union halls, or even mob connects. And always the bonds were fired in the overheated politics of the party. These grumpy suspicions were often repeated by the losers in Kendall County's courtrooms. But in my more innocent moments, I liked to discount them, believing that cronyism, not cash, explained the obvious favoritism I, like every other lawyer, had witnessed on occasion over the years. For my client's sake, I was skeptical now.
"I'll tell you what clinches it for me," Stan replied. "Morton Dinnerstein's uncle is Brendan Toohey."
Sennett took a beat to let the portent of the name gather.
"Brendan's older sister is Mort Dinnerstein's mother. She raised Brendan after their mom kicked the bucket. Devoted to her he is. And to her son. Looks to me like Toohey's given nephew Morty a real helping hand."
As Stan expected, he'd caught me by surprise. When I'd arrived in Kendall County in the late 1960s, a Toohey marrying a Dinnerstein was still thought of as miscegenation. More to the point, Brendan Toohey now was the presiding judge of the Common Law Claims Division, where all personal injury cases were heard. A former cop and ex-deputy prosecuting attorney, Brendan was celebrated for his intricate political connections, his general Celtic amity, and his occasional bare-knuckles meanness. In most quarters, among reporters, for example, he was renowned as able and tough, but fair. Toohey's name was the one most often mentioned when people speculated about who would eventually replace old Judge Mumphrey and wield the vast powers of the chief of the entire Kendall County Superior Court. I'd had my ears scratched by Brendan during my year as bar president. But both Stan and I could recall Toohey's tenure long ago in the felony division, when there were persistent rumors that he was often visited in chambers by Toots Nuccio, a reputed fixer. I asked mildly if Stan thought it was fair to condemn Robbie Favor because of his partner's relatives, but by now Sennett had lost patience with my temporizing.
"Just do your job, George, and I'll do mine. Talk to your guy. There's something there. We can both see that. If he gets religion, we'll cut him a break. If he sees no evil and speaks no evil, he's going to the penitentiary for evasion. For as long as I can send him. And with these kinds of dollars, we're talking several years. He's got his chance now. If he doesn't take it, don't come groveling in 6 months, strumming your lyre about the poor wife and her miserable condition."
Stan set his chin against his chest and eyed me gravely, having become the Stan Sennett few people liked or could even deal with. Behind him, out the window, a boom swung on an immense construction crane a block away, carrying a beam and some daredevil iron worker riding on it. In this town, they were all American Indians, who reputedly knew no fear.
I envied them that. Somehow my father's death had sharpened my lifelong concern about my lack of daring. In the meantime, Stan took my silence for crusty disdain. It was one of the occasional rewards of our friendship that he was vulnerable to my opinion of him, perhaps because he knew so much of it was favorable.
"Did I offend you?"
he asked. "No more than usual," I assured him. He rumpled his lips and stood. I thought he was going to show me out. Stan was famous for that, for abruptly announcing a meeting was over. But instead he perched on his long mahogany desk's front corner. I remembered yet again that I had always wanted to ask how he got to 4:30 in the afternoon with his white shirt unwrinkled. But the moment, as usual, wasn't right.
"Listen," he said. "I want to tell you a story. You mind? This is a real chest thumper, so get ready. Did you ever hear the one about when I knew I was going to be a prosecutor?"
I didn't believe I had.
"Well, I don't tell it often, but I'm going to tell it now. It has to do with my father's brother, Petros. Peter, the kids called him. Uncle Peter was the black sheep. He ran a newspaper stand instead of a restaurant." That was meant to be a joke, and Stan briefly permitted himself a less constricted smile. "You want to talk about hard work? I listen to young lawyers around here pull all-nighters and complain about hard work. That, my friend, that was hard work. Up at 4 a.m., standing in this little corner shack in the worst kind of weather. Bitter cold, rain, sleet, always there. Handing out papers and collecting nickels. He did that 20 years. Finally, near the age of 40, Petros was ready to make his move. Guys he knew had a gas station down here in Dehaney and Plum, right in Center City. Place was a gold mine, and they were getting out. And Petros bought it. He took every nickel he had, all that he'd saved from 20 years of humping. And then, of course, it turned out there were a few things Uncle Peter didn't know. Like the fact that the corner, the whole damn block, actually, was scheduled for condemnation under the new Center City plan, which was announced only 2 or 3 days after Uncle Peter closed. I mean, it was a flat-out, no-good, dirty Kendall County fraud. And every drachma the guy had was gone. I was only a kid, but hell, I'd read my civics book. I said to him, 'Uncle Petros, why don't you go to court? Sue.' And he looked at me, and he laughed. He said, 'A poor man like me? I can't afford to buy a judge. Not, I can't afford a lawyer,' although he couldn't, but he realized that anybody who knew in advance what the Center City plan provided couldn't be beaten in the Kendall County Superior Courthouse. And I decided then I was going to be a prosecutor. Not just an attorney, a prosecutor. I knew suddenly it was the most important thing I could do to make sure that the Petroses of the universe stopped getting screwed. I'd catch the corrupt judges and the lawyers who paid them and all the other bad guys who made the world so lousy and unfair. That's what I told myself when I was 13 years old."
Sennett paused to regather himself, absently fingering the braiding carved beneath the lip of the desk. This was Stan at his best, and he knew he was impressive.
"Now this crap has gone on too long in this county. Too many good people have looked the other way, hoping to persuade themselves it's not true, but it is. Or telling themselves that it's better than the bad old days, which is no kind of excuse."
Somewhere in there, as he had bent closer for emphasis, my heart had squirmed. But it was ardor that energized him, not any kind of rebuke. "And so I've been watching and waiting, and now I've got my chance. Augie Bolcaro is dead, and this stuff is going to die with him. Hear this carefully, because I'll get that son of a bitch Tui and his whole nasty cohort or flame out trying. I'm not going to send a couple of low-level schmoes to the joint and let Tui become head of the court in a year and do it all again, on a bigger scale, which is how it's always gone around here. And I know how people talk about me, and I know what they think, but it's not for the greater glory of Stan Sennett. You know the saying, if you shoot at the king, you better kill the king?"
a paraphrase, I told him, of Machiavelli.
Stan tossed that around a second, not certain he liked the comparison.
Well, if I shoot at Tui and miss, if I miss, George, I'll have to leave town when I step down from this job. I know that. No law firm in its right mind will go near me, because neither I nor they will be able to set foot in state court. But I'm going to do it anyway, because I'm not going to have this go on unchallenged, not on my watch. You will forgive me, George. You will please forgive me, but it's what I owe my Uncle Petros and all the other people of this county and this district. George, he said, it's what's goddamn right.
Chapter 3.
How this started, Robbie Favor said, is not what you think. Morty and I didn't go to Brendan and say, take care of us. We didn't have anything to take care of, not to start with. Mort and I had been bumping along on workman's comp and slip and fall cases. And about 10 years ago, even before Brendan was appointed presiding judge over there, we got our first real chance to score. It was a bad baby case. Doc with the forceps treated the kid's head like a walnut. And it's the usual warfare. I got a demand of $2.2 million, which brings in the umbrella insurer, so they're underwriting the defense. And they know I'm not Peter Newkris. They're making us spend money like there's a tree in the backyard. I've got to get medical experts, not one, four. OB, anesthesia, peds, neurology, and courtroom blow-ups. We've got $125,000 in expenses, way more than we can afford. We're into the bank for the money, Mort and me, with seconds on both our houses. I had heard the story several times now. This rendition was for Senate's benefit, a proffer, an off-the-record session in which Stan had the chance to evaluate Robbie for himself. It was a week after I'd visited Stan in his office, and we sat amid the plummy brocades of a room in the Dulcimer House Hotel, booked in the name of Petros Corporation. Senate had brought along a bland-seeming fellow named Jim, slightly moon-faced but pleasant, whom I marked as an FBI agent, even before Stan introduced him, because he wore a tie on Sunday afternoon. They leaned forward intently on their fancy medallion-backed armchairs as Robbie held forth beside me on the sofa. The judge we're assigned is Homer Guilfoyle. Now, Homer, I don't know if you remember Homer. He's long gone. But he was a plain old-fashioned Kendall County alley cat, a ward-healing son of a bootlegger, so crooked that when they buried him, they had to screw him in the ground. But when he finally maneuvers his way onto the bench, all of a sudden he thinks he's a peer of the realm. I'm not kidding. It always felt like he'd prefer your lordship to your honor. His wife had died, and he hooked up with some socialite a few years older than him. He grew a fussy little mustache and started going to the opera and walking down the street in the summer in a straw boater. Now, on the other side of my case is Carter French, a real white shoe number, Groton and Yale, and Guilfoyle treats him like an icon. Exactly the man Homer would like to be. He just about sits up and begs whenever he hears French's malarkey. So one day, Mort and I, we have breakfast with Brendan, and we start drying our eyes on his sleeve about this trial coming up, what a great case it is, and how we're going to get manhandled and end up homeless. We're just young pups sharing our troubles with Morty's wise old uncle. Well, I know Homer for years, says Brendan. He used to run precincts for us in the Boylan organization. Homer's all right. I'm sure he'll give you boys a fair trial. Nice that he thinks so, said Robbie.
Favor looked up and we all offered the homage of humoring smiles to induce him to continue.
Our case goes in pretty good. No bumps. Right before we put on our final expert, who'll testify about what constitutes reasonable care in a forceps delivery, I call the doc, the defendant, as an adverse witness just to establish a couple things about the procedure. Last thing, I ask the usual jackpot question. Would you do it again? Not given the result, he says. Fair enough. We finish up, and before the defense begins, both sides make the standard motions for a directed verdict, and strike me dead, Guilfoyle grants mine.
Robbie wins liability by TKO. The doc's to blame, Homer says. He admitted he didn't employ reasonable care when he said he wouldn't use the forceps again. Even I hadn't suggested anything like that. France just about pulls his heart out of his chest, but since the only issue now is damages, he has no choice but to settle. 1.4 mil. So it's nearly 500,000 for Morty and me. 2 days later, I'm before Gerfoyle on a motion in another case, and he takes me back to his chambers for a second. Say, that's a wonderful result, Mr. Favor, yada, yada, yada. And I've got no more brains than a tree stump. I don't get it. I really don't. I'm like, thanks, Judge. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it. We worked that file hard. Well, I'll be seeing you, Mr. Favor. Next weekend, Brendan's guy, Kosick, gets Morty in the corner at some family shindig, and it's like, what'd you boys do to piss off Homer Gerfoyle? We have a lot of respect for Homer. I made sure he knows you're Brendan's nephew. It embarrasses us when you guys don't show respect. Monday, Mort and I are back in the office staring at each other. No comprende. Piss off? Respect? Guess what happens next? I come in with the dismissal order on the settlement, and Gerfoyle won't sign. He says he's been pondering the case, on his own again. He's been thinking maybe he should have let the jury decide whether the doc had admitted liability. Even French is astonished, because at trial the judge was acting like he was deaf when French had argued exactly the same point. So we set the case over for more briefing, and as I'm leaving, the bailiff, a pretty good sod by the name of Ray Zahn, is just shaking his head at me. So like two goofs from East Bumblefuck, Mort and I put all the pieces together. Gee, Mort, do you think he wants money? Yeah, Rob, I think he wants some money. Somebody had to finance Homer's new lifestyle, right? We sit on that for about a day. Finally, Morty comes back to me and says, no. That's it. No. No way. No how. He didn't sleep. He hurled 3 times. He broke out in a rash. Prison would be a relief compared to this. That's Morty. Nerves of spaghetti. The guy fainted dead away the first time he went to court, which puts the load on Robbie. But you tell me, what was I supposed to do? And don't quote the sayings of Confucius. Tell me real world. Was I supposed to walk away from a fee of $490,000 and just go home and start packing? Was I supposed to tell this family that's got this gorked-out kid, sorry for these false hopes, that $1 million we said you got? We must have been on LSD. How many hours do you think it would be before they got themselves a lawyer whose word they could trust? You think I should have called the FBI right then? What the hell that mean for Morty's uncle? And what about us? In this town, nobody likes a beefer. So, Morty or not, there's only one answer. And it's like tipping in Europe. How much is enough? And where do you get it? It's comical, really. Where's that college course in bribery when you really need it? So I go to the bank and cash a check for $9,000 because over $10,000 they reported to the feds. And they put it in an envelope with our new brief, and I take it over to the bailiff, Ray. And man, my mouth's so dry I couldn't lick a stamp. What the hell do I say if I've read this wrong? Oops, that was my bank deposit. I've put so much tape on this envelope he'll have to open it with a hand grenade, and I say, please be sure Judge Gerfoyle gets this. Tell him I'm sorry for the miscommunication. I go to a status call in another courtroom, and as I'm coming out, the bailiff, Ray Zahn, is waiting for me in the corridor, and there's one damn serious look in his eye. He strolls me 100 feet, and honest to God, you can hear my socks squish. Finally, he throws his arm over my shoulder and whispers, next time, don't forget something for me. And then he hands me an order Homer signed, accepting the settlement and dismissing the case. A decade later, Favor tossed about his elaborate hairdo, which overflowed his collar in indigo waves, the relief still live in his memory. So that was it. I spun Morty a yarn about how Gerfoyle had seemed to realize that we'd turn him over on appeal and had backed off.
Then I went and bowed down before Brendan's honor guard, his two sidekicks, Rollo Kosick and Sig Malaki. As I'm leaving, Sig says, "You ever get a special case like this, give me a call." So I just kind of kept on from there.
He shrugged at the inevitability of the bad acting that followed and looked around again to see how he'd been received. I suggested he go down for coffee. Sennett was rolling his eyes before Robbie got out the door.
"That's a fairy tale about Mort," he said.
I nearly batted my lashes in my efforts to feign surprise, but naturally I'd given my client a good shaking in private. Nonetheless, Favor swore that for a decade Dinnerstein had remained unknowing, which was just the way that Brendan Toohey, as a doting uncle, liked it. Through the partnership, Mort received half the windfall derived from the corruption Toohey engineered, but bore none of the risk. Robbie alone delivered the payoffs to the judges. Favor claimed Mort was even misled about the nature of the secret bank account at River National. There are people in many occupations, nurses, funeral parlor directors, cops, who often are in a position to recommend an attorney to someone who's had a serious injury. Ethical rules forbid the attorney from sharing the legal fees he or she then earns with non-lawyers, but the nurse or the cop who'd handed out Robbie's card might well ask anyway, and Robbie was not the first personal injury practitioner to decide it was better to pay than have somebody forget his phone number. That was where Robbie told Mort the cash they were generating from the River National account was going, as indeed some portion of it was. Bar Admissions and Discipline, the agency that licenses attorneys, might go after Mort for aiding in these shenanigans if they ever learned about them, but Robbie's explanation protected Dinnerstein against criminal prosecution, at least in our state. Even the tax violations did not meet prosecution guidelines, since Robbie had, in his version, led Mort to believe that the income they weren't reporting was fully offset by these unsavory business expenses. It was all too convenient for Stan.
"He's covering his partner, George, and it's dumb. No matter what kind of deal we cut, when I get the evidence he's lying about this, your guy catches the express for the cooler."
I knew Morton Dinnerstein about as well as I knew Favor, which is to say, not very well at all, only from idle meetings around the Le Sueur building. According to my limited understanding, he was the scholar in the duo, the one to turn out appellate briefs and motions and manage the files, while Robbie played show dog in court. It was the kind of arrangement that succeeded in many offices. I was nowhere as certain as Stan that Favor was risking the penitentiary for his pal. Mort was a somewhat otherworldly creature, with a kinky mass of thinning blondish hair that sprang up in small, unruly patches like crabgrass. He suffered from a noticeable limp, and his soft manner was characterized by a mild stammer and persistent blinking that introduced itself in his lengthy pauses as he was searching for words. Mort's guilelessness and the lifelong symbiosis between the two men made it seem possible that Favor was telling the truth. I argued the point with Sennett at length, to little effect. The other shortcoming in Robbie's account from Sennett's perspective was that Favor had never dealt directly with Brendan Toohey. Robbie recognized that the silent arrangements brokered for him with several judges occurred under the gravitational force of Toohey's influence. The story, no better than a rumor to Favor, was that Brendan got rent, a rake-off on what the judges received from Robbie and a few other attorneys. The money was passed to the two retainers who acted as a sterile barrier between Brendan and anything corrupt, Rollo Kosick, whom Toohey had installed as his chief bailiff, and Sig Malaki, a cop who'd once been Brendan's partner on the street. To get to Brendan, Sennett would need them or some other witness Favor might ensnare.
"Believe me, Stan," Favor told him when he returned, "no matter how much you think you hate Brendan, you can get in line behind me. I've known Brendan my whole life, and I've got my share of stories. I love Morty.
But you think I like the way Brendan's made me the water boy in this thing? Except for the fact that he's got people who'd cut my tongue out and use it for a necktie, I'd love to give him to you. Only I can't. Brendan's twitchy as a cat and twice as careful. Catching him? Good luck.
Sennett appeared to relish the challenge. His eyes lit briefly with the remarkable energy that he inevitably deployed against any serious opponent. Then he beckoned Robbie to go on providing the details he could. Over the years, Robbie had made drops to many judges, and he retained vivid recall of each occasion and of the envelopes of cash quietly passed in men's rooms and cafeterias and taverns to assorted bagmen, and, much more rarely, to the judges themselves. Despite Stan's suspicion that Favor was protecting Mort, or his disappointment that Robbie could not take him straight to Tui, it was easy to see that he was excited, even as he attempted to maintain his familiar veneer of tense restraint. "Is there any reason you couldn't keep making drops?" Sennett asked Favor near the end of the session. "If we leave you out there in practice, everything looking the same as it always has, would you be willing to wear a wire against all these folks and record the payoffs?" That was the question we'd known was coming. It was the big chip Favor could put on the table to keep himself out of the pen. But hearing the proposition aloud, Robbie grabbed his long chin and his black eyes took on an inward look. I could sense him recycling the strong emotions of the last few evenings which we'd spent together, when he'd vented about Sennett and his terror tactics and anguished over the cruel dilemmas confronting him. And then, as I'd learned was his nature, he let go of all that. Instead, he hiked himself forward on the sofa to face the United States attorney and the supervising special agent dispatched from D.C. He did not bother with rancor. He simply told them the hard truth, much as they'd forced it on him. What other choice do I have? Chapter 4. Every successful negotiation is susceptible to Tolstoy's observation about unhappy families. They end up in the same place, but each one gets there its own way. For his part, Favor set simple goals in bargaining with the government. Unlike most lawyers I'd represented, he seemed resigned about the loss of his law license. It was inevitable anyway for someone who admitted bribing judges, and by now practice had made him rich. Instead, he hoped to maintain his bundle in the face of the forfeitures and fines the government could exact. More important, he wanted no part of the penitentiary, not so much for his own sake, he said, but so he could attend to his wife during her inevitable decline. On his side, Sennett's foremost requirement was that Robbie go about his bad business wired for sound and agree to testify later. For that reason, Stan also insisted on a conviction, knowing it would enhance Favor's credibility before a jury if he'd pled guilty to what he was accusing others of doing. Finally, Favor's role as government operative had to remain an absolute secret, particularly from Dinnerstein, who might spill the beans to his uncle. After days of haggling, we made a deal that required Robbie to plead to one count of defrauding the public by bribing various judges. Assuming Robbie delivered on what he'd proffered, the government would depart from the federal sentencing guidelines and agree to probation with a $250,000 fine. Everyone felt reasonably satisfied with these arrangements, except the Department of Justice, more specifically, UCORC, the Undercover Operations Review Committee, which controlled all clandestine operations directed at public officials. UCORC had been established in the wake of ABSCAM, the FBI sting aimed at the Capitol, to calm Congress's newfound agitation about the perils to innocent citizens posed by undercover operations. The innocent citizens whom UCORC was concerned about now were the people on the other side of the cases Robbie would be fixing. UCORC said flatly that the government could take no part in depriving the opposing parties and their lawyers of an honest day in court. Senate flew to D.C. to butt heads several times. Eventually, UCork agreed the problem could be resolved if Favor were to fix only sham cases. The idea was that just as FBI agents had played Arab sheiks in Abscam, they could act the part of the defense lawyers and parties in fictitious lawsuits Favor would file. All of that make-believe, however, would entail a far more elaborate and expensive operation than Senate had envisioned. Many weeks passed while Stan did combat within the department to wring the approvals for his budgetary and manpower requests. It was late October by then, and naturally at that point UCork said no again. The difficulty, they now realized, was that Robbie Favor was an acknowledged felon. The government could hardly allow him to keep practicing law on the honor system. If he got into any of the mischief that could be expected of a crooked PI lawyer, it would be blamed on them. More pertinently, Senate's plan offered no safeguards to keep Robbie from continuing to secretly pay off on the real cases on which he'd still be working in order to maintain his cover. In essence, UCork demanded that Favor practice under police watch. Robbie chafed, but in the end he agreed that an FBI agent could be planted in his office to pose as the new paralegal Mort and he had already agreed to hire to enable Favor to spend more time with his wife. To account for the fact that the paralegal would be virtually welded to his side, Senate suggested that a female agent be assigned, someone who could pretend to be the latest of Robbie's many office liaisons. Late in November, the woman proposed for the role, known as Evan Miller, flew in so we could all meet face to face. At Senate's direction, we each arrived separately at a room in the Dulcimer House. Jim, the agent who'd attended Robbie's proffer, was sitting with Stan when I got there. Jim had become a fixture, and I'd realized by now that UCork had designated him to run the operation. The new agent came up last. She spoke the word Petros, and the door parted to reveal a woman in her 30s of medium height with a sturdy, athletic build and agreeable looks. The first impression was of a pert, pug-nosed girl next door with a sincere, unassuming style. She wore jeans and a polo shirt and a trace of eye makeup beneath her narrow, wire-framed glasses. Her brass-colored hair was pulled back in a ponytail. Yet even there on the threshold, she was noticeably ill at ease. Her brow was pinched, and she advanced flat-footed into the room, shaking hands without meeting anyone's eye. Attempting his usual gallantry, Favor fetched her a juice from the minibar, which she accepted with a polite smile. "So, Yvonne," Robbie pronounced the name as we all had, as if it was a variant on Yvonne. But she shook her head. "Even," she said. "Like, I'll get even. My mom meant it to be said the other way, but no one ever did." I caught Senate's quick grin, a fox in the brush. Even Miller was a nom de guerre invented for her, along with her driver's license and social security card, at FBI headquarters in D.C. Robbie did not realize that she was, in the parlance, telling her myth. "That's just like me," Robbie told her eagerly. "My last name. People get confused all the time. Mine's like, do me a favor." She managed a lukewarm grin, but did not seem fully persuaded they had much in common. Favor plowed on, intent on winning her over. "Which reminds me," he said. "I ask people all the time when I meet them, which do you like better, even numbers or odd?" From her narrow look, I could see she recognized it as a bar line. Clearly, she'd been warned about Robbie and had no use for his flirting. "I like even numbers," he added, with a futile little smile at his pun. She nodded rather than say anything else and moved to the other side of the room, before Senate hailed us to our seats so we could talk over the necessary arrangements to be sure no one in Favor's office questioned even or the fictitious cases.
"Did you say she was a bureau agent or a prison guard?" Favor asked afterwards. To my eye, she'd been no worse than correct.
Robbie, I suspected, was upset by the reality of being watched 12 hours a day in his own office. The truth, though, was that none of us, Robbie, me, even Stan, knew anything about Evan Miller's true identity, any more than we did about Jim and the other undercover agents, the so-called UCAs, who eventually came to work on the case. Project Petros, as the operation was now labeled, ran strictly on the rule of need to know, meaning that all players, whether the agents or Robbie or Sennett, were supposed to receive only the limited information required to act their parts. That would minimize the chance that critical secrets would slip out and bring down the entire facade. The only facts we eventually gleaned about Evan Miller's true background came to us in a roundabout way, largely because Stan had initial reservations about her. He'd found her more tentative than he'd hoped, and was also afraid her low-key style might give her away, since she appeared an unlikely match for someone as flashy as Robbie. Privately, Favor found that concern entertaining. He said he was not known as especially picky. In any event, Jim, who'd been given control over the agents by UCork, stuck by his choice. He was impressed by her personal history, which made him believe she had the resilience to handle the rigors of life undercover. Apparently she competed in the Olympics, Sennett explained to me one morning. He tipped a shoulder, knowing no more than that. We were in Wars Park, where Stan ran several miles at 6 a.m. Stan's mania for secrecy was so intense that he had not yet even informed anybody in his office about Favor. Thus, to avoid questions, we often met here. I'd bought a snappy running suit and followed him once or twice around the tarred oval before we would appear to happen upon one another on a bench. We had gotten together today so that I could hand over documents, the final signed copy of Robbie's plea agreement, and his acknowledgement that he'd reviewed the lengthy written protocol for the undercover operation.